Lecture 20, The Rise of Macedon.
Welcome back. To the north of Greece stretched the immense mountain range called the Balkans. 2,500 years ago, just as today, it was divided among many peoples. It was a dangerous place. The Greeks felt it was only partially civilized because it was only on its margins that the Greeks had colonized and set up those familiar city-states. In the interior were little kingdoms and chiefdoms, mountain valleys connected by precipitous trails over passes, divided by rushing torrents of rivers, each little place ruled by its own people. Now, the people who inhabited the Balkans where the mountains came down to the northwest corner of the Aegean Sea, those people were called Macedonians. And it's their story and the story of the king who elevated them to greatness on the world stage that we're going to tackle in this lecture. Macedon was a kingdom of mountains, forests, rivers, and lakes. They were a terrestrial people rather than seafarers like the Greeks, in spite of the fact that they had the best supplies of shipbuilding timber in that entire part of the world. And so, ironically, the Athenians, who are ultimately going to be subdued by the Macedonians, helped to enrich and empower the Macedonians by sending Athenian gold and silver north to buy shipbuilding timber from these people who still commanded immense forests of pine and oak at a time when Athens and the other Greek states had deforested their own home territories. In fact, the first environmental comment we know of in all the world's literature came at the time when the Athenians were sending all that money north, and it was written by Plato, that Greek Athenian philosopher. What he said was that when we look at Attica today, the territory of Athens, we are seeing the wasted skeleton of a once healthy body. In the time of our grandfathers, these hills in Attica were covered with tall trees, trees whose trunks provided beams for temples and for the keels of ships. They've all been cut down. The soil has eroded down into the sea, and all that those hills are good for today is the raising of bees on the heather. So where did the Athenians go for their timber? They went to Macedon, and they had continuing treaties with the kings of Macedon so they could get that wood to build their ships. Oak for the keels, pine for the planking, and fir for the oars. Those were the three kinds of trees that they were after, and that was Macedon's main source of wealth, was exporting those trees. So the kings of Macedon began to become rich. And as they became rich, they became ambitious. It was their dream that they could unite a lot of that mountainous territory into a much larger kingdom. The man who fulfilled this dream, Philip, knew the Greeks very well. When he was a little boy, he and his mother were caught up in the dynastic struggles that in these kingdoms inevitably accompany the death of a king and the choice of a new king. And they were rescued at a time when they were about to be either exiled or imprisoned or even killed by an Athenian general who happened to be in the area, a man named Iphicrates, who, saving the mother and her sons, managed to ingratiate himself with the new dynasty in Macedon and actually was adopted in as sort of an honorary son of the family too. And so Philip got to know Athens through this link with Iphicrates, the general who had saved him as a boy. And ultimately, when he grows up and has a son of his own, Alexander the Great, we call him, he hired a tutor for Alexander, who was a philosopher who had trained at Athens. He was the son of the former king of Macedon's court physician, and that philosopher is very familiar to us. His name is Aristotle, and he served as the tutor at the court of Philip for Philip's son, Alexander. That was the link to Athens. He was linked to other Greek states. When he was in his teens, Philip was sent as a hostage to the great city of Thebes, down in the central part of Greece. This was a very common thing in the Greek world. If you had ties with another state or kingdom and wanted to ensure peace and good relations, each side would have some important people held hostage at their main city so that there would always be a great threat against the safety of these people should war break out, and both sides would think twice about misbehaving, breaking oaths, and so on. Philip was lucky enough to be at Thebes during the time when the greatest military genius, one of the greatest that Greece ever produced, was living at Thebes. He was a Theban general named Epaminondas. And his story doesn't come much into our Greek and Persian Wars story, but he was the one who brought the Thebans to a high level of perfection and professionalism in the hoplite phalanx, and who at the battlefield of Leuctra in 371 BC performed the seemingly impossible feat of defeating the Spartan army, that once invincible military machine brought low by Epaminondas and the Thebans. Philip had a front row seat for all this. Now, as a hostage, nobody paid too much attention to him. Just as when he was a little boy with Iphicrates, he was just a pawn in the dynastic struggles. So he grew up not much regarded, not much noticed, and people didn't have great expectations of him when he assumed the throne after the death of the old king and another dynastic struggle. But as soon as he had control of Macedon in his own hands, he embarked on a career of conquest. He had different ways, different strings to his bow when it came to taking over territory. Of course, there was always war and invasion, but Philip liked subtler means, diplomacy and weddings, marriages. He had a number of wives, and most of them were politically motivated weddings, because he would find a daughter of an important chief or king, marry her, and then bind that man and his territory to himself, to Philip, through that link of wedlock. The most famous of these marriages was to a princess, the daughter of a king, of a Balkan realm off to the west of Philip's Macedon. Her name was Olympias. He met her on an island in the northern Aegean, an island called Samothrace. It's within sight of Troy. It's a place we have heard of once before, if you remember in the Battle of Salamis, those brave javelin throwers from Samothrace who were serving in Xerxes, the king of Persia's fleet, were seen by Xerxes from his hilltop to do a heroic act when they were rammed by a Greek trireme. They seized their javelins and boarded the ship that had rammed them and took it over, cleared the decks, and made it their own and went off and continued to fight in this captured vessel. So they were tough folk, these islanders. They were also great craftsmen. They were near the metal-producing regions of the north. They brought the metal to Samothrace, and they had a cult of craftsmen there and of spirits who supervised the success of metal workers and craftsmen. And so on this island, there were mystery cults. There were strange festivals that were held in honor of these spirits. Philip went to one of these on Samothrace, and he found there this woman, Olympias was her name, and she was a devotee of strange cults, snake cults, various cults worshiping different demons and spirits. But he saw her, he fell passionately in love with her, and the two of them were married, and the result of that union was this boy, Alexander, one day to be called the Great. They didn't live in harmony for very long. Olympias had a fiery temper of her own. Once she had a son to promote, she was all for Alexander's interests and very upset with Philip for continuing to marry other women, each of whom she was afraid would supplant her as principal wife. So it was a stormy relationship, but he got what he wanted. He got that alliance with her family, her father, and therefore added that area in the Central Balkans to his own sphere of influence. As far as military matters concerned, he was someone who did for Macedon exactly what Cyrus the Great had done for Persia two centuries earlier. He took a remote hill people who seemed far from the centers of civilization and world control, and through training and through inspiration and through a new kind of vision of what warfare could be, he raised them to the most formidable fighting force on the planet in a single lifetime. We know all about Alexander the Great today. Books are written about him. Films are made of his life. But most people who've studied that time feel that Philip is the one who should get the credit for transforming Macedon from a remote hill region into a place that could really consider taking over this great empire of Persia. Now, how did he do it? Well, he looked out at the world around him, and he saw the Greeks and their kind of warfare, and he saw the Persians. Let me fill that in for you, what he was seeing at the time. The King's Peace of 386 has already been in effect for about 30 years when Philip comes to the throne. That has guaranteed that the mercenary armies of Greece are free to go off and do service for pay overseas. In fact, the great king actually said at the time when he mandated the King's Peace in 386, "This is partly so I can hire the mercenary armies I need. If Athens and Sparta and the other city-states are continually fighting each other, the mercenaries I want are tied up in domestic wars. I would like them on the market, available for hire for my wars." Well, he certainly succeeded in that. Not only did the king of Persia manage to hire entire armies, commanded sometimes by Spartan kings or Athenian generals, who were also in the pay of Persia, but rebel states, Egypt trying to break away from the Persian Empire, the island of Cyprus, and at times the satraps of Asia Minor, who would go to war against their lord and master, the great king, and try to become independent, all these also would hire Greek mercenary armies to fight for them. Climax was reached in the 340s when there was a war in Egypt between the native Egyptian king, who wanted to liberate Egypt from Persia, and from the armies of the great king coming in on the eastern front, trying to subdue those Egyptians and bring them back to the fold of the Persian Empire. Each side mainly rested their hopes on big Greek mercenary armies. We were impressed enough by Xenophon and his 10,000 back in 401 BC. There were 35,000 Greek mercenaries fighting on the two sides in Egypt, Athenians and others on one side, Spartans and others on the other side, 35,000 Greek troops clashing along the banks of the Nile. Ultimately, the king won, and Egypt went back into the Persian fold. But it remained the fact that the great minds and the great fighting forces of Greece were scattered through the Mediterranean rather than focused at home, carrying out the policies of any one city. So he sees Greece united. He sees their best strategists and their best fighting forces abroad, disunited, scattered over the face of the map. Now look at Persia. Persia has gotten used to other people fighting their wars. The Persians themselves do not train. He had grown up at the time that Agesilaus, that king of Sparta, was out fighting on Persian soil. Agesilaus himself eventually became a mercenary captain in Persian pay, just as Iphicrates, the savior of Philip, when he was a boy, Iphicrates, the general of Athens, he became a mercenary captain for Persian pay. When Agesilaus wanted to make the point to his Greek troops about how soft and how vulnerable the Persians were, that quality of malakia, softness, he did something that was an outrage to Persian sensibility. He brought all of his troops together, his Greek troops, and then Agesilaus ordered some Persian captives to be brought in and stripped naked. Now, maybe to the Greeks this didn't seem like the horror that it was to the Asiatics, but all Asiatic peoples had a horror of exposing their naked bodies. We're very familiar with this through the Old Testament in our mainstream American tradition, the horror that the Jews had of nakedness, the first thing that Adam and Eve do when they discover a consciousness and are able to look at themselves is make some aprons out of fig leaves so they will hide their shame, hide their nakedness. Greek men didn't feel this. They didn't feel this shame about the body. They were proud of stripping down for their athletic contests and their wrestling and their running, displaying the male nude in sculpture and art. But to these Persians, they were being shamed and degraded to have their robes pulled off and their white, untanned bodies put on public display. What was Agesilaus' point? Well, Persians didn't have an athletic tradition. Individual Persians were not in great physical shape the way most Greeks were because of all of their training in the gymnasium. And so he was saying, look at these people. These are the rulers of the world. These are the rulers of the powerful empire that you fear and that dictates to you. Look at them. They're pale. They're weedy. They're unmuscular. Why are we fearing these people? That display, which so angered the Persians, left a very indelible mark on the minds of people on the other side of the Aegean, the Greeks and the Macedonians. And a lot of Persian prestige, a lot of the sort of aura of fear that they'd been carrying around about the Persians was diminished by considerations like that. So to Philip, it all looks doable. He's got a problem that Cyrus the Great did not have 2 centuries earlier when it came to turning a small kingdom into a great empire. Cyrus the Great's Persia was an upland plateau on the edge of a great empire. The cousins of the Persians, the Medes, as you will remember, had already conquered the world from Central Asia to the middle of Asia Minor, modern Turkey. All Cyrus had to do was conquer the Medes, one people, and he had an empire that had now fallen into his lap fully formed. And using that as a base, he then went on to conquer Lydia, the Greek cities of the Asiatic coast, Babylonia and Mesopotamia, and ultimately died trying to add even further parts of Central Asia to his new Persian kingdom back in the 6th century BC. Philip did not have that luxury. Philip was surrounded by small, fragmented kingdoms, realms, city-states. He had to tackle them one by one. But he was a man of tremendous patience, intelligence, foresight, and energy. And with these qualities, he set about, from that time in the 350s when he got the throne of Macedon, he set about the process of conquering the world. The fighting force that he created to be the match of Greeks or Persians or the Balkan hill tribes all around him looked at first a lot like the traditional Greek phalanx. The men trained with round shields, they trained in closely knit lines, shield to shield, and they came forward masked several lines deep. The big difference was their weapon. He invented a spear called the sarissa, twice as long as the spear of the Greek hoplite. So it was almost 20 feet long, certainly over 18 feet. It's much more of a pike than a spear. And the front row of the phalanx would have their spears coming out over their shields, and then the row behind would also have their spears protruding forward and another row. So there was this wall of steel points facing the enemy, and the ordinary hoplite couldn't get anywhere near the front row of the Macedonian phalanx. And yet the Macedonians were already delivering death blows with these formidable weapons. Now, it took a lot of training. Philip militarized Macedonia. He created this army that was a permanent army, owing their allegiance to the king, training all year round, making themselves tough and hardy. If you remember back to Cyrus the Great's comment about hardy lands breed hardy men. Well, Persia certainly fit that bill until the Persians decided to move their centers down onto the plains. First at Susa, now they've started camping out at Babylon even, the ultimate whore of cities of easy living and high luxury. Macedon is still rough. He's able to command the loyalty of these men who are fierce fighters almost from boyhood, but keep them tied to the throne. No mercenary service for them. They are going to be at home serving the interests and the policies of their king, Philip. Now, remember his name, Philippos, lover of horses. He was very interested in the cavalry also. In Greek warfare, typically, cavalry, the Greeks didn't know what to do with it. If you remember back to the Iliad, the charioteers are basically taxi drivers who deliver the heroes to the front. They hop out of their chariots and then fight a duel with somebody, get back in the chariot, and go home. This is no way to use horse in a battle. And Philip saw, as he looked at the Greek city-states, that though they're aristocrats, like Xenophon, trained as cavalrymen, they didn't use the cavalry in a sensible way. They hung around on the fringes of the action. They might make an initial charge on a hoplite phalanx, trying to disorganize it. And certainly during a rout, the cavalry would come into their own, chasing down fleeing soldiers and spearing them in the back. But they were not organic to the system. He treated the cavalry seriously. He had horse and his phalanx of sarissa-wielding soldiers work together to be this formidable duple or doubled force that could be very mobile and quick with the cavalry and then this immovable block of armed men with the infantry. He studied the art of war. He also studied sieges because he was after cities. All those Greek cities along the coast, the Greek cities that guarded the famous gold mines of Thrace. He captured them, and therefore all of the wealth of those mines came into his treasury. And he went up to the Hellespont and began to tackle the towns that guarded that lifeline of trade that brought the wealth of the Black Sea with its grain, its salt fish, its slaves, down into the Mediterranean. He began to assault those cities from land and sea. He would mount catapults and siege engines on his ships and tackle these port cities from the waterside. So he was a thinker, he was an innovator, he was willing to try everything, and he didn't mind failures. There's something inevitable if you read the short version of Philip's life. He just seems to have rolled to success. It wasn't like that at all. If the Greeks had really gotten together to oppose him, if they'd called all their mercenary armies home, gotten their good generals out of Asiatic service where they were getting rich, and staying far away from the troublesome democratic mob in Athens, which, a little like American politics today, any high-ranking person is going to have their private life pried into, is going to suffer all kinds of slurs, is going to be limited in their actions, maybe hauled into court. Much better live as a mercenary warlord in Persia and fight for the king and reap the rewards of your ability. The Greeks, if they had done that, could have stopped Philip. But they didn't. And of course, that's why they got in the fix they were in. They couldn't act in a serious, concerted way about unification or about national priorities. So one by one, he began to tackle the defenses of Greece. He managed to ingratiate himself with a large number of Greeks, first through a religious series of steps. He appeared at the Olympic Games. He also competed, as his predecessor Alexander of long ago had done. He became a protector of the Delphic Oracle. He joined religious movements in Greece as an important supporter of Greek religious life and the various sanctuaries. That was one of his methods in. He also used money, just as the great king did. Macedon is rich now. It had all that money from selling the timber. Now it's got the gold mines of Thrace. Philip's a sensible man. Anything that gets people to open their gates, he's willing to try. There's no great sense of honor about him. He's already been involved in one siege that cost him one of his eyes when he was inspecting his siege equipment, and somebody up on the wall shot an arrow down and took out one of his eyes, left him with a bad wound there. So he's quite willing to buy his way in. So he buys the support of people all over Greece. In Athens, he found an actor named Aeschines who was interested in getting into politics. Yes, if you've got a good actor's training and you've got a good voice and you can play different parts, the perfect politician. So this Aeschines was in Philip's pay, as it turned out later on, and all the speeches he made in the Athenian Assembly were paid for by Philip to promote the idea of not resisting Macedon. Our policies lie along the same path. We should welcome this partnership with Macedon, and we should let Philip do what he wants to do. And then there were quite disinterested Greek politicians like Isocrates, not strictly a politician, but certainly a political thinker, who just admire Philip. They've given up on the democracy of Athens. They've given up on the independent Greek city-states. They're looking for a strong unifier, and they think Philip is that man. So they admire him without being paid. They're quite genuine in thinking he's the answer. They tended to be upper-class people who just felt that we need, at this point, a strong hand. Now, there were resistors, and the most prominent of these was the Athenian orator Demosthenes. And it came to a point, finally, where it seemed that there was one little scrawny Athenian, Demosthenes, a boy who was born with a stutter, which he overcame by standing on the seashore, putting pebbles in his mouth, and shouting at the waves so he would master his tongue and learn to enunciate properly and build up the chest and the lungs that would allow him to dominate the assembly as he wanted to do when he grew up. This Demosthenes gets up in front of the people of Athens again and again from the 350s onward and warns them against Philip. He is the great threat. He appears to be a friend of the Greeks. He appears to be a protector of Greek sanctuaries. He appears to be someone who is only bent on carrying Macedon to its natural limits and creating order and stability in the north of Greece. But beware, my fellow citizens. He plans to take over all of us. He is the evil genius who will rob us of our freedom. Well, he would then be immediately countered by Aeschines, the tool of Philip, getting up and denying everything that Demosthenes said and saying that Demosthenes was only motivated by self-interest. The Athenians should send yet another embassy to Philip to ask about his plans. And while that was going on, Philip would take two or three more cities or rob the Athenians of yet another port somewhere in the northern Aegean. So with this playing off of one group against the other, Philip was pretty proof against Demosthenes and the other detractors. Now, Demosthenes made a beautiful point, or at least beautifully put point, at one stage of this conflict that I think bears keeping in mind today. He stood up in front of the Athenian assembly and said, "Do you realize how difficult it is for me to combat someone like Philip? Here I am, a private citizen of Athens. All I can do is try to persuade you, the voters, the citizens, to vote one way or another. I have no real authority. I can't command anything or anybody. I am subject to having everything I say contradicted and put in the wrong light by the next speaker on this platform. And everything I say about strategy and policy and new initiatives is said in the open air to thousands of people and immediately carried to Philip by spies from this assembly, and I know you are out there." What does Philip do? He concludes in his own mind, as absolute master of his kingdom, what will be his next step, and without asking permission of anyone or telling anyone what he is doing to give advance warning, he orders it. "I am one man. He is a kingdom. How can I hope to succeed?" And here we see the difficulty that real democracies have in waging war. The deliberative process slows things down. Elements can be brought in that in fact impede a straightforward, energetic pursuance of an objective. And so the dictator always has it easy when it comes to facing a democracy when they come to battles and military campaigns. Through all this, Philip was succeeding more and more, and at last he brought his armies down into Greece and met the united armies of Athens and Thebes at a place called Chaeronea, not too far from Thebes on the Boeotian plain. And there was the army he'd known when he was a kid as a hostage in Thebes, the famous Sacred Band of 300 Thebans. And there were the Athenians, the descendants of the people who'd beaten the Persians at Marathon. And here was his army, Philip's army, his tremendous Macedonian phalanx with those long pikes, his son Alexander commanding the cavalry. The two armies met, and it was a tremendous victory for the Macedonians. These Athenians, these Thebans, some of them died heroically on the field. Many ran away. Demosthenes, who was there, was one who threw away his shield and ran away so that he could live and fight another day, but very ingloriously, very shamed, giving his opponents a handle against him for all time to come. Right after this great success, which dropped Greece into Philip's lap as a place he could control, as a place where he would be hegemon, war leader for all the Greek city-states. As I say, he's not added them to his kingdom. They are still independent, and he wants them to be happy to think they are autonomous and independent. But he now governs their foreign policies. He summons them to the Isthmus of Corinth, that traditional place for bringing the Hellenic League together, and he recreates the league that fought Persia. And he announces to the Greeks, "We are going on campaign, I will be your leader, and at last, we, united, we Greeks, shall conquer the Persian Empire." It was at this time that he received a letter from Isocrates, incredibly in 338 BC, still alive at the age of 99, and still writing, and still promoting the Pan-Hellenic dream. Isocrates wrote in this letter to Philip, "It is now in your hands. You have shown yourself able of fulfilling all of our hopes and wishes for you as the strong leader that Greece has been yearning for. Unite the Greeks, conquer Persia. Take for yourself the wealth of that continent, and there will be nothing beyond that for you to do but become a god." Prophetic words spoken by the voice of the oldest living Greek to the newest figure on the political scene. And as we shall see next time, the prophecy was to be fulfilled, but in ways that neither Isocrates nor Philip could ever have imagined.